Today we're going to talk to Tim Stafford, a frequent guest on Real Bluegrass. You probably know him, probably on his solo projects, certainly as a member of the award-winning bluegrass band Blue Highway. I don't know if there's anything they haven't done yet and achieved, and they're still going strong. Tim has released a brand new solo album, Tunes and Ballads. We're going to talk at length with Tim. He always has great insight into the lyrics and the music. There's a lot to uncover when you've got Tim Stafford on the show. Let's listen to Wild West from that album, Tunes and Ballads, and we will begin our discussion with Tim Stafford right here on Unreal Bluegrass. To the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard a new song, Wild West, from my guest today, a frequent contributor to Unreal Bluegrass, off of his brand new album, Tunes and Ballads. I'm so happy to welcome back once again Tim Stafford. How are you, Tim?
I'm doing good, Steve. How about you, man?
Doing as good as I can. I assume that you are also.
I am, and it's just one day to day. A lot of things. Glad 2020 is over, but new year, new challenge. we're struggling through.
This new album, and I want you to talk a little bit about Wild West, the song we just opened with. Is on Hedge Drive Records. I assume that's available through a website for you. If someone just looked up Tim Stafford, they would be able to find it.
Yeah, it's on timstaffordguitar.com, okay. On my store. And, it came out actually in December, but I'm still promoting it and trying to get the word out there.
Did you put most, if not all, of this together in the year 2020?
I did. I had the idea to do it for quite a while. It was about time for me to do a record. And I was just working on it, trying to get the tunes together. And then I thought about putting it off because Steve Gulley and I have a duet record that's been done for a while. Before Steve got sick, we were finished with it. And it's going to be on Mountain Home, and Mountain Home was kind of trying to decide whether to put singles out, put the record out, and they decided now to put the record out in March of 2021.
Don't I have a single from that, though?
You do have. Yeah. There's been two singles, okay. Actually. And so the whole record's coming out in March. So I decided to go ahead and put mine out. I talked to the people over there at Mountain Home, and they thought, well, you know, it's not really going to be that much of a competition with the record with me and Steve. So, and the singles that they're putting out are ones that Steve sang on. So, you know.
Sad. That was a sad day. We've had some sad days, as you know. I want to talk about, there's a song on here that you finished with Steve. We'll talk about that in just a minute, but the Wild West song that we just let off, with other thing, what too? Don't let me forget this, and you won't. Since the last time we spoke, Tim, Tony Rice on Christmas Day, it's just a devastating loss for the entire world of music. I know who Steve Gulley was, but I didn't have that, you know, incredible attachment to this genius that was Tony Rice. I know you did. You wrote a book about him in 2010, Still Inside, I think is the name, as roughly as I recall.
That's right. It was his authorized biography that we worked on for 10 years. So Caroline Wright and I co-authored that book. So, yeah, I mean, it was just a shock to find out about Tony. And the word just sort of filtered out from close friends. John Cowan called me, and I ended up calling Wyatt Rice to see if I could confirm it, and Wyatt hadn't heard about it yet. So,
oh, man.
It wasn't a good situation, and really hate it, but, you know, the outpouring of praise and just great thoughts about Tony since his passing just proved to me what we knew all along, that he really changed bluegrass music, you know. The language that he sort of created on the guitar puts him right there, I think, with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs.
Yep.
At the forefront of this music. Just a handful of people have ever done that. He's one of them.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think Tony stands maybe not as dramatic a departure, but when Earl Scruggs hit the scene, it was like there was all these other banjo players, and I know there were three-finger players that didn't play with that same syncopation and that same style, but Earl came and it was like, where did that come from? And then the world kind of shifted to Earl's style, and then there were, in the 60s, there were some melodic things, and I always say that Bill Keith really kind of shot that off. There's Bobby Thompson and other people, but the point being, Tony Rice, I think, is one of those watershed moments in the guitar players that play in the field of bluegrass. It was everything is now seen through a different prism, and it was Tony's, it was his incredible rhythm and backup, but then the solos that he took, and let's not ever forget about his singing voice. I mean, he changed so much that you can't even separate out from what is the formula of bluegrass in your mind. It's part of that world.
Yeah, when I hear bluegrass today, I think I hear Tony's rhythm style as the most dominant thing in the music that's changed over the last 30 years or so, 40 years. And he's responsible for that. There's no doubt that people followed his lead and his approach to rhythm, which was really, really different, even though he was a big fan of Jimmy Martin's and Clarence White. His rhythm style just really, really, really changed everything and became the pattern that we still hear today in modern bluegrass. And nobody can really play it like Tony except for maybe Wyatt.
Yeah.
You know, he's the guy that comes closest. Nobody can really duplicate it, but it's a sense of rhythm and a sense of how you play notes and chord substitutions. And you could teach a master class on Tony Rice style rhythm guitar. Because I think it's more important than his lead. A lot of people talk about his lead, and his lead was impressive, and it could be very flashy, it could be, you know, all these things. And obviously, he had great tone and timing. But his rhythm style really, really changed the whole music. And, of course, like you said, he was a great singer, man. I mean, to me, one of the best singers, obviously, who's ever sang bluegrass music in his prime.
I think he sang Gordon Lightfoot songs better than Gordon did, and I thought Gordon was a great balladeer, but I just thought when Tony got him, it's like, that's all you could hear anymore.
Yeah, he made him his own, and Gordon himself said that at one point that Tony was his best interpreter.
That's great. Well, I wanted to touch on that a little bit because it has happened since the last time we chatted. I think everybody knows in the audience that Tim Stafford has been and is a regular member of one of the most recognized and awarded bluegrass bands in history, I think, the Blue Highway. And I know every once in a while you do these side projects in addition to what you're doing with the band. And this is one of those, Tunes and Ballads. And I'll just tell the listener, it is, the ballads are stunning. The tunes are amazing. We're going to talk a little bit about your guitar playing because half are tunes or more than tunes or split it evenly. I don't care on the ballads that you write. And these are just some amazing songs. The song we opened up with is Wild West, which is one of my favorite storied ballads on the song, on the album, if you'd care to talk about that just a little bit. It's a great story.
Sure. It's something I've been meaning to write for a while because I was such a fan of Buffalo Bill Cody. And, you know, the American West in general and the characters who came out of the American West and just the whole point being that they were real people, you know. They've become so legendary it's hard to peel back the legend and find the real person. But every now and then you'll see a book come out that tries to do that. I've written songs about Billy the Kid, Wild Bill Hickok, you know, Doc Holliday. It just goes on and on. It seems like there's never ending people associate me with Western outlaw ballads or whatever. But Bill Cody was a really important guy because he was kind of legendary before he started this Wild West show in 1883. But the Wild West show is really kind of his legacy, and it was a way to carry on this vision of the West that was already disappearing right at that time. You know, Frederick Jackson Turner wrote his great essay about the frontier in American history. In 1890, it came out, the same year that the Census Bureau said that the West closed. And so, you know, around this time that it was fading away, he started this Wild West show as a nostalgia, you know, for people in the bigger cities. And it was immensely popular all around the world and the United States. And he would have people like Wild Bill Hickok, Sitting Bull, Annie Oakley, real horses, riders, cowboys, you know, native people, sharpshooters like Annie Oakley. And it was just an attempt to memorialize the West. And one of the most popular outdoor entertainments that's ever been thought of and put on in this country or the world. And so this is a look back at his life and his Wild West shows as entertainment and as a look at a way of life that was disappearing.
You know, and I don't hear many songs about the Wild West, in particular the show aspect of it that you're talking about. So that kind of struck me. I don't know that I could put my hands on another song about, but certainly songs about the Wild West, or what we believe to be those characters, but I don't think this song is about those shows.
Yeah. I can't remember one either. I know there are probably some out there, but I wasn't familiar with them, and that's one reason I wanted to write it. But it just is also a topic that's always appealed to me. You know, I've got posters here around the house. I've got books about it. And it just, to me, it was the popular imagination about the West, the idea of the West, which to me is still a big, important thing, because sometimes that can be as important as the real West.
Well, and I think at some point, I don't know this historically, but I got a feeling at some point they sort of merged because of the influence of the idea of the Wild West. Not in a real successful way, because I think living there was really difficult, and I don't think somebody coming down the main street with a shiny gun is really going to do much, but I do think at some point the legend and the reality of it sort of touched.
They merged. They did touch. But, of course, once you had television and movies coming.
Yeah, that's true. Once Gunsmoke came around, it was all over. That's my first favorite ballad on this thing. You start off the album with a straight-out instrumental, Beach Creek, and then the one right after Wild West. I'm going to hit a couple of instrumentals here with you, Tim. Galapagos, which stuns me, and then you have Red Haired Boy. So you've got Wild West kind of surrounded by several instrumentals. Your playing style to me, and your singing style on this, is just it's a very I'll say intimate. It's a lot of you and your guitar, and inside the album, you tell everyone all the guitars you're playing, which I appreciate that information because I like to read that stuff. But it's a very intimate. Personal album, I think, even in the instrumental tunes. And then when you get to some of the we'll talk about the last Clinchfield run in a minute, but talk a little bit if you want about starting off with Beach Creek and Galapagos, Red-Haired Boy. I don't know if I said girl or boy, Red-Haired Boy, but just go through that a little bit.
Well, you know, Beach Creek and a lot of these instrumentals are ideas that I've had over the years that I've recorded. I'll record something and put it down, and then when I think of I'm playing a lot, and I just think, well, that's good. I'll record that. So when I do that, and I'm able to put together some of these instrumentals from some of the pieces that I had that seemed to fit. And but Galapagos was I was messing around with an open tuning called Dadgad, D-A-D-G-A-D, which is very popular in Irish music. A lot of Irish guitar players play in this Dadgad tuning. But I didn't know that at the time because when I wrote this song, I was only 25. This was the mid-80s that I wrote this song, some 35 years ago. And I came up with it, and I started expanding on it a little bit. And at the time, I was listening to a lot more classical music. I had just gotten out of graduate school at Miami. I was working on a PhD in history. And so maybe that some of that sort of seeped through in Galapagos, and I recorded what I had and was able to save that recording. So I had to reteach it to myself when it came time to do this record because I always wanted to record the tune. And Dave Egger, who I know is an unbelievable prodigy, he was, and now he's just a virtuoso, a cello player, played with everybody from Foreigner to Trans-Siberian Orchestra, to you name it, everybody in the world, every He's got Robert Redford on speed dial. It's just incredible.
Wow. He was going to be someone I wanted to elaborate because I don't know him at all. And he only plays on cello on this one tune.
Yeah, and the thing is he made a local connection here, and he started recording some in this region when he first did a thing with Ralph Stanley years ago. And it kind of drew him into this area, and now he's got a house here. He lives here part of the time, although he's from New York City, and he lives there most of the time. But Dave, I mean, it's incredible. You know, he took piano lessons when he was a kid from Aaron Copland. He's an absolute genius on his instrument, and kind of guy that, like, in between, I had to catch him in between. He was doing a Nike commercial one day. So you hear him all the time. Nobody knows who the guy is, probably, but he's on half the commercials that come out, almost all the soundtracks. The guy's just, he's incredible. And I was lucky enough to get him to play on some tunes on my last record. And actually, I think a couple of different records besides this one. So hardly anything I put out, I'm always going to use him in something, you know.
You know, when you write a tune like Galapagos, and I will in all likelihood play that in the first hour of this complete program, do you think in terms of, I need a cello for this part?
I didn't at the time I wrote it, but in retrospect it just made sense because I wanted something that sounded like an orchestra to fit the tune, and it seemed like the tune needed something like that. And because it was originally envisioned as a solo guitar piece, but knowing Dave and what he's played on previous things I've done, I thought he'd be perfect for this, and he was.
It's a beautiful tune. It's just, well, the audience will have to hear it, and they will if they listen to Unreal Bluegrass long enough. They'll catch on, and I'll be able to drop that in every once in a while. I want to get to, you mentioned Steve Gulley a little bit. The Last Clinchfield Run is a song, as I understand from reading the liner notes, that it might have been. It was finished. Well, you explain it. It's a great song. It's about the railroad, as I understand it. But can you talk a little bit about the Last Clinchfield Run?
The area that I live in here in East Tennessee, there's a town called Irwin, which at one point was the headquarters of the Clinchfield Railroad, which became the CSX. And for years and years that was the case. And my dad, when he was a kid, he ran away from home one summer to work on the Clinchfield Railroad. But I was reading on social media, it was big news around here because the CSX pulled out of Irwin and closed down the rail yard. And the day or two that it happened, I think it was back in 2015, one of the engineers for CSX wrote this incredibly moving account of his last day as an engineer for CSX. And I had to read it like four or five times. It was one of the best things I ever read in my life. His name is Joe Barr, B-A-R-R. And so I started writing this song immediately and had most of it finished, and I couldn't come up with a few things. And Steve was coming over to the house, and I said, man, would you help me finish this song? And he was more than happy to. And so it's an absolutely true story. A lot of the words were taken right out of Joe's account. And
it sounds pretty specific. I was kind of thinking that was the case, that you were telling a real story. I don't know how literal it was, but I could tell that it was something that was really happening. I also don't know the city that you live near or grew up in. Yeah,
100% literal. Yeah. And I'm just glad that I was able to get Steve to help me finish it, and he wanted to put it. We were going to put it on our duet record, but I said, man, I think this will probably fit mine better because it's just going to be guitar and vocal regardless. He may have put on a harmony part if we put it on our record. I'm not sure, but yeah. You know, otherwise it's pretty much the same.
Right. That to me, Tim, talking to Tim Stafford, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about Tunes and Ballads, his brand new album. I think that's a perfect lead-in. Let's play for the audience from that record, The Last Clinchfield Run. It's a great song about, it did happen. It happened to a lot of railroad lines, but it's history, and that's what happened. You do a wonderful job of capturing that whole loss, I think, which was, it's one of those things that had to happen, I suppose, because of travel, but, boy, you really captured it well. So let's play The Last Clinchfield Run, and I'll be back with Tim Stafford. And that was the tune we just talked about, the last Clinchfield run. Tim, you write, you do, everybody seems to, well, they strike that. Let's put that out of the record. You write great songs about railroads.
I don't know what it is about railroads and trains. I did mention that my dad worked on the Clinchfield Railroad when he was a kid, so maybe that was part of it, because he did tell a lot of stories. And, you know, I mean, he was like 14 or 15 when he did that. So I guess it was burned in his memory. And part of the stories that he told ended up being the basis for the song, Through the Window of the Train.
Yeah.
And so, you know, trains are big in bluegrass. I'm not, you know, it's just the way it is.
Well, I think they had a lot of significance. There were a lot of train stations. There were a lot of centers where people worked. My grandfather came from Somerset, Kentucky, and came up to follow the railroad up to Ludlow, Kentucky, and worked on the railroad. It's and then, of course, things die around it. But, I mean, I guess he figured it was dying down there and moved up so people follow those things. And there's a lot of history and mythos involved in railroads. And they're always a great subject. That's a great song. You have other ballads. I'm gonna skip down a little bit, come back to the song we're going to end with. But The Marks, beautiful, beautiful tune. That you wrote with Joe Newberry. Let me list some of the ballads I want to touch on. The Marks, gorgeous. Sail Away to See the World, incredible song. London Town, I'll tell you, the listening audience now, I haven't heard many songs about this particular topic. You use a term for the star of the song, if we want to say that, I only know by virtue of a movie entitled Spinal Tap. I didn't know that was the name that other people used, but and Arizona Tears. There's a lot of great stories. And again, you're on guitar and vocals. Dave Edgar joins you on Galapagos. Jacob Burleson, who I think the audience knows by the name of Thomas Castle. I'm going to say his last name is Castle or Castell. Mm-hmm. Castle.
Okay. Castle, yeah.
Is that pretty much the cast of musicians that you have?
Yeah, it's as Larry Sparks would say, it's mostly me. but, yeah, Dave plays on one song. Jacob plays – he actually backs me up on several tunes. And Thomas plays a mandolin twin with Jacob and plays a lead on Red Haired Boy, which is a traditional tune, you know.
Public domain, your arrangement. The Marks, let's talk about that, because it's a beautiful concept. I have a story that relates to that, but not that good, and I know that you and Joe wrote the story with the same idea in mind, so talk a little bit. That's one of the ballads on the Tunes and Ballads album.
Well, Joe has a 50s model Gibson J45, and I have a couple of 40s models. When we were comparing guitars, I've also got a 30s model, a couple of 30s model D18 Martins, and we were just playing each other's guitars and all that, and he said, "Man, don't these things smell great?" And I said, "Yeah, there's something about it. You put your nose down in the sound hole and smell that, and it's like you're smelling the years. You know, it's just, it comes back to you." And that is the idea that brought this song about, was the smell of the guitar, but we ended up expanding it to the look of the guitar, and of course made it about this guy's grandpa and how he couldn't play the guitar anymore, but the boy ended up doing it. And it's one of my favorite songs I've been a part of. And Joe says that every time he does it, people really love the song. So I'm glad that he came over to the house that day and we started playing our guitars.
Joe, I'm a big fan of Joe Newberry's. He's been on this, been giving me so much great music and so many great references and stories. Here's my version of that. It's not the smell that you described in this. It's a wonderful song. I don't mean to take away from that by telling the story, but my great-grandfather was a fiddle player, and all of them were down in the country, as we call it, in Kentucky. They all played music. And I never understood why his fiddle had a certain odor, smell to it. I never knew what it was. I thought it was just part of being out in the middle of the country. Things smelled like that. Until long after he passed away, I went back to find the old farmhouse. Somebody was living in it. They were renovating it. And I went in. And I asked him, I told him the story. You know, I was a kid. We'd come out here and spend the weekend with my great-grandparents out in the middle of nowhere. Grant County, not that far from me mile-wise, but you might as well be 300 miles south from me. And the people said, oh, yeah, we remember that connection, so they let me walk around. And so I'm walking around this house that's being rebuilt, and it finally strikes me as I get near underneath the stairways, they had a cedar closet. And the smell in that fiddle, it was always, because he was always farming, so the fiddle picked up that cedar smell from inside, because that's where he put it when he was done with it. And every time we went over and played, he got it out. I didn't know as a kid what cedar was. After all those years, and this was just a few years ago that I finally connected it. I don't know what took so long, but there was that cedar smell. I have that fiddle, and you open that little beat-up case, and it's bam, you're back in the farm. You're back in the farm. It just still blows my mind. It just does. But those connections are so real, and the marks. It's a great song about. We'll play it eventually. I probably might play it in some other part of this program. But it's a wonderful song. One of my favorite ballads. I want to hit some of these. I want to talk a little bit more about the ballad "Sail Away to See the World," kind of a new look at a boat that everybody remembers.
Yeah, the Titanic. Yeah. Craig Market and I got together, and I said, "Well, I'd like to write a song about the Titanic, but I don't want to do the normal, you know, historic recitation about it or anything like that." And he said, "Well, you know, maybe we can look at from the point of view of the iceberg." And so that's how it started. We were going to write the whole song about the iceberg that the Titanic hit, as if it, and personify it, you know, tell its story.
Mm-hmm.
But then once we got into it, we realized that we couldn't do the whole song like that. So we did it from the point of view of several of the people who were involved in the Titanic story. The iceberg, the men who made the ship, who were mostly from Ireland. Came to Liverpool to make her. And then, you know, the ship itself and the captain, you know, and leading up to the sinking of the ship. So, you know, and the idea was sail away and see the world, which is what causes all these young kids, or did at one point especially, to get involved in maritime work, you know. So it's a little different.
It is. And you have a couple other songs that are really different. The tune that precedes that ballad on the album is Coburn Banner. Is that sort of a, am I just imagining, because you mentioned the Irish, is that sort of an Irish Celtic kind of tune? In my mind, it sounds that way, but I don't know why I think that.
Well, Coburn Banner is sort of a little fingerstyle ragtime piece, and it's named that because the guitar that I played it on is a 1945, we think, Gibson J45 all mahogany that I bought from somebody from Coburn, which is where my wife's from, and which was also Ralph Stanley and Jim and Jesse's hometown, Coburn, Virginia.
Okay.
And it's a banner, Gibson, which it has the banner on the headstock that says only a Gibson is good enough, which is a story all by itself, because those guitars were only made during the war by women. They were the only ones left in the factory to do most of the work on the guitars during the war. And there's a great book called Kalamazoo Gals about those women. And the last one just passed away, and Tom Yates and I, of course, had to write a song about that, because so we wrote a song called Banner Gals. It's going to be, I think, on a record he and I are putting out next year or something.
Oh, I can't wait to hear. I love Tom is one of my favorite songwriters. He's always into that historical stuff. That's okay. Yeah, that makes sense. The Coburn Banner. Then maybe that's not the tune I'm thinking of, but Take the Ferry, which is then followed by London Town, is another instrumental.
Yeah, London Town's about Jack the Ripper, and just I had this mournful tune, and I wanted to put something mournful to it, and I was thinking of Tony Rice, and some of these Gordon Lightfoot ballads that he would do that told these tales about forlorn things, you know, and or sad things sometimes, and I didn't want to write a song about a serial killer, but he was the first one that was, you know, that we know about. I'm sure there were others before him, but he was memorialized by the mass media. And the thing that got me about Jack the Ripper, obviously he was a terrible person and, you know, a sick person, but he was the first person that was talked about, he was never caught. And we have no idea who he really was. And there's all kinds of books that have come out. People claim to have solved it. And they never really have. And it's just one of those enduring mysteries of who was this, you know, that was able to do this at a time that in industrial England, when, you know, things were changing a great deal over to a modern industrial type of society. But, you know, that story's just always been, I wouldn't say fascinating to me, but it's one that's still unsolved.
You know, I wasn't sure that was... I mean, I read your notes. I listened to everything before I read your notes, and I wasn't sure. And I thought, yeah, I guess it never has been solved. If you just tune in, you know, go ahead.
He was also the first killer or anybody like that who actually wrote things to the press.
Well, that's it. And the song, are some of the story in the song taken from some letters?
It's taken exactly from his words that he sent in the letters that he sent to the London Times.
As I was listening to this song, I didn't know, I wasn't sure what it was because I hadn't read anything yet. I listened to everything first, and then I heard you mention Saucy Jack, which, I only knew that term to show my ignorance because of the Spinal Tap movie. If you remember that, at the very end, they were all breaking up, the band was breaking up, and two guys were going to do a musical called Saucy Jack, which was a musical about. And so when you said that, I thought, gosh, I guess he's singing. So then I opened it up, and I read everything, and I only recognize that name because of that connection. But, yeah, there aren't many songs written about Jack the Ripper, Tim.
No, I know, and probably should keep it that way. But, but still, you know, I don't know. There's something about the tune that appealed to me that it might fit on this as a ballad. You know, the way ballads used to work, too, is they were precautionary tales. And it would be the type of thing where you put this story about what happened as a cautionary thing to people to prevent it from happening to them, you know. And the old broadsides, a lot of them were that way. And I kind of saw this thing as a new broadside, kind of a tribute to the form.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let me mention this phrase from a song, and I think this is... I know exactly what it means, and I think anybody would, but as I listen to, I'm skipping down, I'm not going to tell you the tune yet, the tears flow up, they don't flow down. That song to me, that phrase alone, you should know exactly, everybody, I think, if you think about it, should know exactly what you're referring to.
Yeah, if you've been to Pearl Harbor and you've seen the Arizona Memorial, you know that the wreck is still leaking oil. And they call them Arizona Tears. And when I visited the memorial, the Park Service employees tell the story, and they say that the legend is that these are the tears of the sailors. There's 1,177 sailors who are still entombed in the Arizona. And so the legend is that those are the tears, and the legend is also that when the last survivor of the Arizona attack dies, the tears will stop. And I just ran chills up and down me when I heard it, and I immediately wrote down Arizona Tears, you know.
I've never been there. I've heard the story, and I knew other people that had been there before, but apparently it's just like the oil surfaces and drips. And someone told me how long it would be before they thought it would actually empty. I'm guessing an estimate, but it's a long, long time before that process of like one drip floating up. That's why they float up, because it's oil. But someone told me once, how many
years?
Yeah,
actually, it's not just one. I mean, it's pretty.
Is it everywhere?
Thick at times, yeah. I mean, it's it just kind of leaks out. Sometimes it's not very much, but sometimes it is. And the account, I have a fictional account where there's three brothers, two who died on the Arizona and one who comes back 80 years. And the reason I did that is because they also told us that at the time that up until that point, every person who was on the Arizona who survived, when they passed away, they chose to have their remains, if they were cremated, reinterred with the ship.
Wow.
And so in my story, that's what happens. The third brother, when he passes away 80 years later, which would be right about now, you mm-hmm. know, and we're getting up to that point with a lot of these guys and nearing in 100 years old, he decided to have his remains interred with the ship with his brothers, and the tears stopped. And so,
wow.
It's a legend, and it, most likely it'll outlive the survivors. And there have been two or three survivors since I was there who've chosen not to be interred with the wreck. So that tradition sort of broken.
How long ago were you there?
I believe it was 2003, somewhere in there, 2004. I can't remember. Rob Ox and I had a show that we did in Hawaii as a duet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the reason why we're there.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, it's a ballad. There's so many ballads, like you said, tunes and ballads, and that's what it is. And the tunes, we're gonna work our way back up, but I'm not finished with the bottom part of the album yet because there's other instrumentals. There's Happy Day. There's Winville's Last Day. I wanted to ask you who Winville was, but tell me a little bit about that, and then maybe Pretty Little Job. Then we're going to talk about the other ballad that really striking to me. It may be the only other one we haven't discussed. This is Shenandoah Valley Blues. But tell me, who is Winville?
Well, when I was trying to name these tunes, and this instrumental, Winville's Last Day, is in open C, which I've always done at least one tune in open C tune. It's a C9. And I had the tune, and I was trying to figure out what it sounded like so that I had an idea what to call it. You know, after a while, you kind of run out of ideas if you're not careful. You got to be creative in what you call these instrumentals. One time I was listening to Sirius XM, and I heard Ned Lou Brecky played one of my tunes called Mama Llama. He said, "That's called Mama Llama," which proves we've truly run out of names for instrumentals.
That sounded like Ned.
I was trying to think, and I had a couple of names for this particular instrumental, and I had Winville's Last Day written down because Winville, and it's spelled like that because that's the way my son, when he was pretty young, probably would have been 5 or 6 years old, he was building a snowman one day, and he built the snowman. He and I built it out in the yard, and he called it Winville. And it was spelled like this, W-E-N-V-E-L-L.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, that's too cool. I got to write that down. And the thing about it, Winville was pretty tightly packed, so he survived all the rest of the snow. I mean, he hung on for a week and a half. And so he slowly melted every day. And in one part of this tune, you can kind of hear it. It's sort of like a flowing thing. And I think of Winville melting when I hear that. So I remember Winville's Last Day. It was like he slowly, slowly, he just shrank and shrank and shrank. You know?
You cover the Titanic and you cover the melting snowman. That's about as broad a parameter. That's about as broad a parameter that you could find. And then throw in Jack the Ripper. It's a good collection. The Pale Blue Dot I bounced over now because I forgot about it. And then Pretty Little Job, the last cut on the album. And then I'm going to bring you back to what an instrumental that just blows my mind for a lot of reasons. But if you could maybe just hit on Pale Blue Dot, another very pretty tune.
Yeah, it's an instrumental. It's very slow and mournful. And I love those kind of songs, and I was trying to think of what to call it. And the Pale Blue Dot is actually from the book Cosmos by Carl Sagan. He described the Voyager mission, Voyager 1 and 2. And there was one point in the Voyager mission when they were out in the Neptune and Uranus region, real far reaches of the solar system, and the camera actually turned back around and took a shot towards the Earth, and the picture is just amazing. I encourage everybody to go online to find it because it's just incredible. It shows this ray of light, and in the middle of this ray of light, mm-hmm. from so many millions and millions, hundreds of millions of miles away, there's this tiny little dot of blue.
It's actually blue. Yeah, I've got the book, and then they made a TV series, but the original Carl Sagan book, you can find a reprint of it.
But his point was that in that picture, that little tiny dot is everything that everybody's ever lived on Earth has ever thought, ever hoped for, everything we've ever done. And it brings us all together, I think, in a way that, you know, it's like, let's put these differences aside, because from that distance, we don't have a whole lot between us. There's not a whole lot of difference.
No, not to the rest of the universe.
Nope, there's no difference at all. Yeah. And that pale blue dot is a pretty mournful tune. And what I'll do is I'll try to name something after I've written the tune, and I'll play the tune and listen to it and say, does that sound like that? And I think, to me, it does. Pretty Little Job is another one of those tunes. I had written a tune. I was trying to think of what to call it. And this is something that my wife, Janet, her dad would always tell people who were working for him or with him, saying, you're doing a pretty little job. And the point was, you praise them and they'll work harder, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's something she'd tell me, I'd be doing something, working on a toilet or something. And she'd say, you're doing a pretty little job.
So you get that initial bounce, but then you realize that you're being pushed forward.
I've been played.
You've been played, cool. That's the word. But in a nice way, but in a really nice way.
Yeah, in a real nice way. I enjoyed being played.
That's right.
So, yeah, that's what that's for. No, it's a, and a, I thought it's a real lilting little tune. Yeah, it's just a cool way to end the album.
One of the tunes that, well, the one you had no composition or maybe some arrangement, in 1966, I don't do Casey, the top 40 thing, but in 1966, Bobby Hebb released the tune, and I think it's been recorded. I looked it up because I thought it must have been. It's been recorded so many times, Sonny. And it was the song, you know why, you know when he wrote the song, and I'll let you explain it if you want. But this is an instrumental on the album that the song was written, if I can describe this correctly, with a lot of space in the music. He was a guitar player, a very good jazz guitar player. So he wrote the tune as he's writing the song, looking out, you know, whenever he composes it. So I say as a musician, there's a lot of space to move around. And you take this tune, Sonny, and it's just a jaw-breaking arrangement and instrumental.
Well, I appreciate that, Steve. Yeah, I always love the tune, man. Actually, there's a website. A guy has started a website that features a new cover of Sonny when he finds them, and there's almost like one a week that's still coming out. It's just crazy how many people do this song and have covered it. But I just remember hearing it years ago, and I found out later that Bobby Hebb wrote it about his brother who'd been killed. I think he was shot. I can't remember. Or it might have been a car accident. But he lost his brother, and I believe the song is actually about his brother. And I love the lyrics, but I really love the tune. There's something about that tune. I must not be alone because there have been so many instrumental covers of it. I wanted to capture the original feel of the song, and so I did it in the same key, and I did the same key change. It starts in E minor, and it goes to F sharp minor, just like the song did. And I felt like I could maybe interpret it. And I go back and listen to the lyric and see if there's something, some way that I can play that will evoke the lyric. And that's something that I've always learned from Earl Scruggs. There's this great story how John Harper went over to Earl's house one time, and he said, what's your favorite record? And he pulled out a Pete Fountain record. You know, the jazz player.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And pop jazz, you know, he did some pop hits too.
Oh, sure.
He said, why do you like this song? And he put it on and played it for John. And he said, can you hear the words? He's playing the words. And what he meant by that is that's, and he said, that's what I've always tried to do, is that Earl would play the second break that he did to a song different because he was actually playing the second verse.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was trying to play the words. He made the banjo talk, literally.
Yeah.
And so I think if you try to take that approach, you can hear a different thing on different verses and stuff. I try to do that if I can, is try to actually do the second verse, you know, different verse. And so that's the approach here with this version of this song. It was a great song.
It's a great song, and you did a great interpretation. It really is. And if you check, if people go after the show and check how many times it's been recorded, it will absolutely blow your mind as to how many covers have been made. And like you said, there's a website. It easily could do one a week, but it's just one of those tunes. It's a beautiful song if you sing it. It's a great melody if you play it. And then that's going to be the song that we leave with. I only just now remembered, as you were discussing Earl, that Tim Stafford does impersonations.
I can't help myself.
I've heard it. You do Earl. You do a great Ralph. You do, you name whatever. But now we've pretty much taken all our time talking about this album. But Tim's a very multi-talented individual. And the impressions, we just got a small taste. But you're right. Earl said, play the words. And,
yeah.
And when you get away from that as a banjo player, you can be extremely skilled. I appreciate it. But at some point, unless somebody's really charting it out in their head, you lose the melody, which is, I think, is where the lyrics grab hold.
Yeah, it's a different way of looking at it. And a lot of people that are instrumentalists, they just think about licks, or they think of, you know, phrases and that kind of approach to the instrument. But if you think about it as you're actually a voice, you know, when you take a break. And so you want to have something else to say when it comes the second time around. And of course, what I'm doing here is a solo record, so I've got nothing but...
Yeah, you got all the words.
Chant at it.
Yeah. You know? That saying, which I've heard before about Earl, is to me akin to Duke Ellington saying, it don't mean a thing if it doesn't have that swing. And he was serious. I mean, what he was trying to say is, I think, don't get too far out there. If it ain't swinging, you're missing something. And I think that was his way of saying a similar concept of what you stay grounded to. Man, Tim, we're going to leave with Sonny from this Tunes and Ballads great album. Thanks so much again for spending so much time with me for the audience of Unreal Bluegrass. We will find you again. I feel like the last of the Mohicans. When everything frees up and we can get out again, I will find you. I used to see you once or twice a year, and as I go through this show throughout this COVID year, we'll call it, I'm talking to people and I'm thinking, well, I haven't seen you for a year. Well, nobody's seen anybody for a year. But we'll get through the other end of this, and this is a good way to start 2021 with this great album, Tunes and Ballads. Congratulations.
Thanks so much, Steve. I appreciate you having me.
All right. Well, here's Sonny, and I'll let you go.
Thank you.